Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to the Writing Mama Show here on BTR's World of Ink Network. Normally we don't have this show. It's kind of one of those special edition shows when we have an author who we invite to come talk with us that isn't a children's, well, I should say isn't a children's author because some of them do write children's, but their book isn't a children's or a young adult book. So that's why we're not having stories for children's show today. Instead, it's the Writing Mama Show. It's March 5th, and it is 4 p.m. Mountain Time, so that would be 3 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern Time for those of you who are tuning in. And this is your host, V.S. Grenier. And today I have with us Magdalena Ball. She is an author of a newly released novel. It can be for older teens, if they want to treat it, called The Black Crow, Sleeping Before Evening, Repulse Thrust, and it has a wide number of collaborations, anthologies, and poetry chapter books. So it's a fun kind of book, and there's also on our description page, you'll see that there's a link to grab a free little mini flipbook of The Black Crow there for you to kind of look through and get a little bit of a sampling of. But we're glad to have Magdalena Ball with us today. How are you doing this evening?
I'm very well, thank you, Virginia. It's great to be here.
Yeah, now I know you, obviously this book is more for adult readers, which is why we have it on the Writing Mama Show today, but you also have written for, I want to say, the children's YA market as well. So you've covered a couple of different genres with your writing. You don't write just in one certain specific genre, I should say.
No, I don't write in one genre. I have actually never written a children's book, though I have some pressure on me from my own children to actually do that. All of my books have been geared towards the adult market, but I have written in poetry and nonfiction as well as in fiction, so I am a bit of a multi-genre writer. you never know, though. One day I might well write a book for my children. It would have to have things like exploding heads and aliens in it, so I'm not sure I'm up to that.
Of course. My teen keeps trying to get me to write a little bit more of, you know, since he's, you know, I have a teenage son, so he, of course, wants a little bit more of that gross humor kind of book, or, you know, he's really into the Crusades, so something along those lines. I'm like, you know, that's just not my area right now. I'm not
that's
a humor
right.
writer, and I'm not a historical fiction writer.
Yeah, I'm a very realistic sort of writer. I tend to have I come in the realistic tradition. So putting aliens in is just not going to work for me, I don't think. But you never know.
Now, what, I'm just kind of curious, what inspired you to write your newest book, The Black Crow? I mean, I've read a lot of, especially because I know we're both on a lot of social network sites together with other writers, so sometimes we share, you know, articles, of course, in writing, and sometimes we share our own little snippets of writing and samplings. And I've read your poetry. You're a phenomenal poet, and if some of that could rub off on me through the phone, that'd be great. Because I can't rhyme or write any kind of poetry. It doesn't matter if it's rhyme, haiku, or whatever. I can't do it. But what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've been I guess some years ago, my husband and I actually considered the notion of a tree change, which is behind this book. And I think as the global financial crisis began to bite hard around the world, it struck me that really the work that I was working on, which initially was about a tree change, it was about a high-flying corporate couple with their mm-hmm. family who decided they'd had enough of this fast-paced life and wanted to completely leave and go completely self-sufficient in a small farmhouse in Tasmania and raise cows, hence the title mm-hmm. Black Cow. So that's the reason why I wanted to play with that idea. We decided not to do that, and house prices in Tasmania actually went up a little bit too high to make that viable. But I thought it would be fun to play with the idea anyway. And then as the crisis, the financial crisis began to bite, I thought, well, it would be really good to tie in the whole situation with the economy, with this situation that this family finds themselves in, and actually mirror the economy with this one couple and look at it from that perspective. So I began to really focus on the impact and you know, things like government surplus spending and how we were encouraged not only by governments but by marketers to spend and you know, and stimulate the economy and work harder and work longer hours. And you know, I actually saw people around me going through that kind of, you know, run harder, work faster, work more, you know, spend less time with your family and communicate less. And you know, really, creativity is often the casualty when hours get longer and pressure increases. So again, I wanted to play with those notions. They were interesting ones to me, and explore that in the context of, you know, my own real slight bent towards a sustainable life, simplicity, and all of those things that interest me.
No, no, it makes sense. One of the things my husband recently has gotten into, and I told him he needed to read your book. I only got a chance to skim through just because we've been updating our websites with Stories for Children Publishing, so it's been kind of a crazy few weeks. But, you know, I skimmed through it, and he lately has been watching a lot of the Doomsday Prepper kind of shows and stuff because just what's going on with the economy. And it seems a lot of people have really been focusing on how they can be more, you know, self-sufficient. You know, obviously the Doomsday Preppers, I think they find the crazy ones out there to, of course, have on the show, so they're more entertaining. So I'm not saying your book's like a bunch of loonies because they're not. But, you know, it's definitely, I think, something that a lot of people are thinking about more than they used to. I know it's something my husband thinks about, you know, with the way the economy is and, you know, just kind of, you know, things that we can do to kind of prepare. And then, of course, you know, watch what's going on and, you know, certain things happen, you know, basically, you know, where are we at position-wise to, you know, to handle the ups and downs with unfortunately, and the world economy is so tied to each other now than it used to be. So I think it's great that you know, you have a book that touches on some of those, you know, kind of things that people are starting to think about, you know, even if it's not consciously, subconsciously in the back of their minds to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, interestingly and gratifyingly for me, I do find that, you know, even when I give the synopsis to people, they often will come back and go, oh, God, that's my life. So I do feel the book, and I'm happy to see that, is touching a nerve in people. And people are starting to, you know, are saying to me, you know, that really is something that that mirrors what we're going through. But, of course, also the whole notion of, when we reach, and again, a lot of people, it's the same for a lot of people, you know, you reach a certain point in your life, that kind of 40-ish point. Some people might call it midlife crisis if it doesn't go well. And certainly there's a hint of that in this book as well with the main protagonist. But, you know, that notion of getting to a certain point, and often in life we go on a track, you know, doors open, and we take those doors, we walk through them, and we take the opportunities that come, and we have certain perceptions of what success means. And you get to a certain point in your life, and maybe the kids are starting to grow up and things are easing off a little bit, and you start to say, okay, so, you know, what does my life mean? What am I here for? What is the purpose of my life? And again, those are some notions that I wanted to explore, and I in the context of the plot of this book, this notion of, you know, when you turn 40, what happens when you begin to explore the life that you created for yourself? You know, this, you know, that sort of talking heads, oh my God, what have I done moment.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And it's true. I mean, I know some people look at my picture. I hear it all the time. And a lot of my author pictures are not overly dated, but they're, you know, back when I first started writing, so it's been a good 5 years since I've updated them. But if you look at my pictures, like, oh, you look so young. I'm like, you know, I am pushing 40. and I sit here a lot thinking, you know, I do this even now with my writing, you know, career, not just what's going on with the economy or, you know, I think everybody, like you said, you know, we get to a point in our lives where we sit down and we think, you know, okay, this is all the things I've accomplished. You know, these are my plans right now, but, you know, do I want to be doing this 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now? You know, what are my future goals and plans? And you kind of look at, you know, what worked, what didn't work, when were we happy, when we weren't, you know, aren't happy. There's a lot that I think we think about, and especially in times like this, you know, we think about it even more. I mean, I walked away from my old career. I thought one day I'd be a CEO of some, Fortune 500 company, working in retail and with my background in merchandise marketing, and, you know, who would have thought I'd be a stay-at-home mom, AKA writer, editor, and everything else in between, you know, 7 years later, 10 years later down the road. So, it's very true. Now, I know, because you and I had talked about this before, your cover, I love your cover. It's very adorable, but it does kind of give the impression of that it could be a children's book. So I would love to kind of talk about the inspiration behind the cover, because I love the cover, but I know you had made a call with someone that thought originally it was a children's book because they just saw your cover and went, oh, what a cute children's book, which it's not. We know Black Cow is not a children's book. So who designed your cover, and what was, you know, where, you know, what exactly, you know, was the inspiration from the book that made the cover, you know, of your book?
Sure. Well, the cover was actually a painting by this wonderful artist. His name is Aaron Jasinski. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting because I was looking to replace the cover for my first novel, Sleep Before Evening, which I never much liked. It's a little bit blurry. So I was looking around for images, and I came across an image of his, of a girl on a piano, which I just thought was stunning, phenomenal. And I'm still quite hopeful now, especially now that I'm about to say it on air, that my publisher will replace that cover with the other one that we found, because it's utterly gorgeous. I can't even really describe it other than to say it's a girl at the piano, but it's such a beautiful, vibrant image that picks up the book stunningly. So I locked into that, and I sent it to them, and they said they loved it, and, you know, we decided we would go with it. But, of course, they'd already accepted Black Cow for publication, and we were looking for cover ideas for that. And, you know, B. Wright Books is a relatively small publishing house. It's traditional, but it's small. So they often will collaborate with authors on covers or ask authors for ideas. And we thought, well, why don't we look through Aaron's other work and see what else he's got, and see if he's got something that might be suitable for Black Cow. And I came across this image of the girl reading in the fields with a – it's actually a kind of purple ball, but it'll do. So in the background. And I thought, oh, that might work. You know, there's a whole – lots of subtleties there. It does look a little bit childlike. There's a certain naive quality to it, as is often the case in Aaron's work. But also there's just a bit of a bite. You know, some very contemplative look on the girl's face as she's reading. Her eyes are closed, and she's kind of lost in thought. Yeah. And it just struck me that it picked up some of the subtleties about the, I guess, you know, the notion of a life change and of contemplation and of taking the time to sit under a tree and read. You know, there's just this sort of very subtle, I don't want to, a cover that, you know, really gave the whole entire plot away. You can't really do that anyway. But I thought it was striking enough to catch the eye at the same time as sort of picking up on some of the subtler themes. And, of course, having a bovine in the background I thought was quite nice as well, quite a nice touch.
Yeah, no, I love the cover. It's a beautiful cover, and it's very eye-catching. And I agree with you, because I think, at least from, you know, from what I got, from when I was able to, you know, like I said, I didn't really get to sit there and really digest your book 100% like I really wanted to. But I was reading through it and you know, getting the basis of the story, you know, in my mind. You know, it's true. I think, you know, at least for me, I know when I walked away from my corporate life and got into writing and stuff, you know, I found that that old happiness childlike quality that I didn't have anymore as an adult, because we do. I mean, you wake up every morning, you're doing the 9-to-5 grind. I mean, you kind of become a cranky old person. And so I love the fact that there's a little girl on the front, because to me it makes me think, you know, well, you know, maybe they're rediscovering, you know, some of that innocence and childlike quality that we forget as adults as well, as they've made this change in their lives, you know, in your story. So I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you're really right about that. And that is true. That is true, that the characters are almost too adult in the beginning.
Yeah.
And part of their growth, you know, paradoxically, part of their growth through the story is to rediscover their childhood dreams and rediscover who they are inside at core. And so, yes, absolutely. That's very perceptive of you.
That's kind of what I thought, you know, because when we were talking about that, I was like, oh, I really need to read her book, because I remember, you know, saying it's not a children's book. I know the cover can, someone thought that at one time. And so then I started, you know, like I said, reading the story and stuff, and because I did read the first few chapters, and then I had to, like, skim after that. And I was like, well, you know, this is kind of making me think that maybe, you know, they're rediscovering their childlike side again. I used to always joke about when I got older and retired, I was going to have a llama farm. I was going to be a llama raiser, you know, herder and have llamas. And my husband keeps joking with me. He's like, I guess in 20 years we have to start buying those llamas. I'm like, yes, we're going to have llamas. I don't know why that was always my thing. What
was
that?
There were some other black cats in the book as well. There are some other black cows. There's the Steely Dan song, which comes along in the beginning, and there's also the drink, which, of course, the Steely Dan song is about. So I like to just put them in as little props.
Now, what made you pick Black Cow? I mean, is it something personally for you, or is that just, it just happened to turn out that way, or?
Well, I guess really initially I wanted to, the whole notion was about this getting back to the garden idea. So I really wanted, you know, them to be digging the dirt. But I thought it's not enough to make a living. So they really need something that's going to actually earn them some money. And Wagyu cows are actually pretty hot at the moment. You know, they're selling pretty heavily to the Japanese market, particularly here in Australia, where we've got, you know, we've got really good export capabilities to Asia. So, and there are places in Tasmania that are raising quite successfully Wagyu cows. So ultimately, this is what they decide to do, is to become cow farmers. That's the main income that they earn from their farm when they move to Tasmania. So that's their, you know, literally, it's the black cow that causes that they go to raise these black cows. Wagyus are black, so there are, you know, quite literally black cows. But also there are moments in the story. There's a moment in the story where James, the key protagonist, does a bit of cow whispering. Where he goes over and he begins to tell his problems to this cow. And it's almost a kind of epiphany, you know. There's a moment when he realizes, it's as if he's actually admitting things to himself.
Yeah.
So the black cow also stands for, I guess, almost symbolically, where they're going.
Yeah.
But then I wanted to play with the lots of different black cows. And I quite like the words. Somebody actually told me, one of my earlier readers told me that he thought that the title Black Cow was a little jarring. But I quite like the jarring nature of it. I like that it was unusual as a book title.
No, I do too. And because I teach a class over at our community college. They have a continuing education, you know, class that they do for the community. And so I teach basic writing over there. And we were just talking about titles a few weeks ago, and I kept bringing up Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, because it's such an odd, I mean, it doesn't roll off the tongue easy until you get used to saying it, and it's such an odd title. And I'm like, you know, those are really the kind of titles that grab people's attention and make them go, well, what would that be about? So I love the fact that, you know, you have a title that's like that, you know, Black Cow. It's like, what? What would that be about, you know? And it does. It makes you kind of stop and wonder and want to pick up the book and check it out just because of the title alone. And then, of course, they see the cover, and it's going to be over in the adult section. And they're like, well, wait a minute. You know, this isn't quite what you usually expect to see for an adult cover, because usually it's hardly any, you know, any type of cover art, or it's, you know, very, usually business or action-packed kind of cover art, and yours isn't. It's very, you know, it's very vivid, but it's beautifully done. And, you know, so I think you have some great combinations, you know, just to get the reader to gravitate to the book. Besides the fact you're a wonderful writer anyway, so that will only, you know, ice the, you know, the deal for them. But
thank you.
Now, what was that?
Just thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Now, your characters, because, you know, I find that when I write, I tend to, I always pretty much draw from personal experience, somebody I've known in my life. Sometimes it's family, but, you know, a lot of the times it's people I've worked with or people I've known for a short period of time and have made some type of impression on my life. So are any of your characters in Black Cow like that? Are any of them actual, you know, you personally or at some point in your life or someone you've known at all, or are they just completely just they came to you and you just had to write their story?
Look, I've been saying this a lot lately, so I'm going to say it again on air. Any similarity between the characters and situations within its pages and places or persons living and dead is unintentional and coincidental. This is a work of fiction, guys. Really, it's not about you.
You know, it's hard
okay,
sometimes.
Having said that, I don't want to too vigorously because people might worry. I am a bit of a magpie. I can't help it. Maybe it's just something to do with not having, you know, enough of an imagination to set things on Mars and put aliens in. But as my children love to tell me. But, you know, I do pick up on stuff around me. I think most writers are intense observers. We can't help ourselves. It's kind of part and parcel of what makes us writers, that we tend to look at things. And we tend to look at things and people and situations from a lot of different angles. Again, it's just our nature. We watch, we observe, we pick up. And like many writers, I'm something of a magpie. I can't help it. I will hear something I like, and it will go in there, and I will use it. I will see things that interest me or bother me or, you know, lodge in me like some kind of grain of sand, and I have to use it. That's just the way I am. So people will definitely recognize themselves in it. There will be people who will go, hopefully, you know, positively will say, I really, you know, I feel that this is true to my life. And I think that I'll just quote Jane Smiley because I've just finished her Charles Dickens biography, which is superb. You know, as you know, I'm a reader as well as
yes.
a writer, probably a reader first and a writer second. So I'm always reading. And one of the things that she says in there, which I really love about Dickens, but I think about writers in general, is that what novels do is they privilege the idiosyncrasies of individuals. And certainly this is something Dickens did quite well, which is to, you know, to actually find idiosyncrasies in individuals that are interesting, and then use those to demonstrate larger ideas as the characters work out those idiosyncrasies through action and contemplation. So
I totally agree with that.
Yeah. So the ideas, the larger ideas that we're working on as novelists, they're kind of, they tend to be, and I always aim for them to be universal. But I will pick up on lots of idiosyncrasies that people do and that people I know do and, you know, I guess people that are close to me do, and I'll use them because I find them interesting. And I find that, you know, any particular individual's idiosyncrasies will strike a chord in other people. You know, we're not all that different. The things that make us unique and interesting are still things that other people will see and relate to. So I do use stuff. I definitely use stuff. And I will sometimes, you know, to the pain of other people who know me, I will use things that they have said to me in my work.
Yeah. Well, I always tell everybody when I'm doing workshops or if someone, you know, is interviewing, asking me, I tell them, you know, writers are kind of like we're a walking live recorder. You know, I mean, and you totally nailed it perfectly, especially, you know, talking about Dickens. He's one of my favorite authors. I actually have his whole collection at my house because I love him and William Shakespeare. And it's for us to really have good storylines. I mean, we have to totally, I think, you know, like you said, be open and see everything from different angles. I mean, every workshop when I was first learning to write, I mean, the biggest thing that that they focused on would, you know, is to, of course, open yourself up and to really focus on your five senses and what's going on around you, you know, to really open up your perception on things and look at things differently. So, you know, that's how you, and I think you totally agree. I mean, that's really how you know that someone's written a good story is when they're able to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And but, you know, I will also say that a lot of me is in there. So in different ways, in different shapes, and, you know, in the most unlikely of protagonists, not necessarily in the ones that might look a bit like me. You know, the female protagonist Freya, for example, is not necessarily any more like me than, for example, the male protagonist James. But they all have bits of me in them. You know, there's always something. And and sometimes I've had moments. You know, I was late to picking up my son from cricket a while back. It was a couple of months ago. I'm usually pretty good, but I was running a bit late. I had a trainee checkout person in the supermarket, and I was quickly doing the food shopping in between. You know, I had to go pick him up from cricket, and I was late. And my daughter, you know, my children never let me off the hook for anything. My daughter likes to make fun of me because I was quite upset as I was going to get him. I didn't like the fact that I was late. And I, you know, I was like, oh, I'm turning into Freya, my protagonist. There is a scene in the book where she's actually, well, she never actually comes to pick up her son from a cricket match. It doesn't turn out very well. It's quite an unpleasant scene, probably the most unpleasant scene in the book.
And I'm going to say, I can relate to that.
I'm the bad mother in my own book.
Yes, and you know, but that's a good thing. I mean, to really have a book that I think readers can understand and relate to, like you said, I mean, they have to, you know, to connect and be able to identify things that they do in their own lives with those characters. And, I mean, yeah, I'll be the first to say, I mean, I've talked about this on many of my shows, and usually people hear it mostly on my Family Matters show because, you know, that whole show is focused on family and I don't want to say it is values, but I don't want to say, like, they're just my values. I mean, it's just we talk on different subjects, and, of course, people will call in or we talk about, you know, the different perspectives out there of different value types based on that subject. And, you know, I'm always the first to admit that I'm surprised people listen to me. It's probably why they listen to me, hear what the next worst thing I am as a mother, because I'm always talking about what a bad aunt mom I am. And my kids, of course, they always tell me I'm not that bad. But in my corporate life, I mean, my gosh, there were so many times we had accidents on the freeway. And, I mean, anybody, I used to live in California. And so anybody who's ever been to California knows that the 5 and the 10 freeway in Southern California are like parking lots and accident nightmares. And so you were, like, you know, playing roulette every time you go on the freeway about having, you know, a 5-car pileup. And one time that happened, and then my husband was coming from the opposite direction on the same freeway and had a pileup. And my poor son was sitting there at school waiting to be picked up, and neither one of us had gotten to him yet. And when my husband finally got there, because he got there before I did, he walked in, he looked at our son, and I felt devastated when he came home and told me that. He's like, are you okay? You know, were you worried? And he's like, no, I just figured your mom died on the freeway. And, I mean, here he is at 8 years old saying this, and I'm just going, oh, my gosh. You know, he just figured, you know, someone would eventually come get him from some other family, you know, member, because we must have died on the freeway. And I just felt horrible as a mom. I'm just like, ugh. And ever since then, of course, I try my best, you know, to never be late picking up my kids. Of course, I've been late once picking my daughter up from first grade, and she about, like, had a heart attack because I was 2 minutes late. But, you know, yeah.
You know you're a writer, though. You know you're a writer, don't you, when you're actually feeling the guilt and thinking,
yes.
I can use this guilt.
Yes, and I do.
I'm sure I can use this guilt in something I write.
Yes, I'm like, one day I'll write this. I have a couple of stories that are based off some, like, really bad tragedies that have happened in my life. But I'm just like, you know what? It's probably one of the best ways to deal with that, you know, all these years later, is to write about it and to focus it and come at it at a different way and maybe have a better ending to what really happened. Rewrite the story, right?
That's right. So would you like me to read a little bit from the book, just to give you a feel for it?
I would love for you to read a little bit.
Okay. I've got it in front of me, so I'm ready. What I thought I'd do, I have read from the beginning before, but I thought what I might do is just read a little bit, and you just tell me to stop if I'm going too long. I'll only read a little from chapter 13.
Okay.
Because I thought that would be quite a nice scene. That is the first trip that the family take in a long time together to a place called Cradle Mountain, which is an absolutely, utterly beautiful part of Tasmania. Tasmania is a little island. It's part of Australia. It's a little island down the south, just in case those of your listeners who may not be familiar with it. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. I love Tasmania. And the family take a little holiday there. So they go to this place called Cradle Mountain Lodge, and it's the first time that they're together as a family not working. They, you know, they, both of them, both parents are workaholics, and the kids are moving in that direction as well. So, chapter 13. As they pulled into Cradle Mountain Lodge, James breathed in deeply. Freya was still talking about sustainable farming like raspberries and cheese, none of which took his fancy, though he liked the idea of working with cows. It brought back a childhood memory he wasn't able to shake. Exhaustion came over him as he remembered how he'd worked late last night trying to get things done before the holiday. Then he caught sight of Dove Lake, with its mirror finish and the mountain in the background. There was something about the dark blue of the water that revived him. It was absolutely still, despite the low-hanging cloud that was moving in. No hint of wind appeared on the surface, not even a ripple. The distinctive volcanic mountain sat behind it, with gradations of green against the light gray and blue sky. Orange-hued beech trees sat subtly amidst the greenery, and he remembered pointing them out to Freya 17 years ago. Had they been married that long? So many changes had taken place in the world between then and now. James felt a pain, but it wasn't like the usual twinge he felt every morning as he pulled his car into the office parking lot. It wasn't the pain in his shoulder which came and went, on and off. That wasn't hurting now at all. What he felt was more like hunger pangs, though the feeling wasn't one that would be satisfied by food. It was almost desire, a kind of sexual sensation in his groin, but he didn't know what for. He looked at his family, who were looking around with him, their funk stopped by a collective intake of air as they got out of the car. They felt it too. It was obvious in their faces. They were all hungry. His family was starving and they smelled food. What he needed to do was capture that look on their faces so he'd remember to feed them. Taking out his phone, he snapped a picture and then looked at it. No one even looked happy in the picture. The image hadn't captured that commingling of surprise and desire at all. All the megapixels in the world wouldn't be enough to get the way the light hit the water, the pristine coldness of the air, and maybe, above all, the age of it. The ancient, jagged edges and wildness preceded them and would be here long after they'd been buried and disintegrated back into the ground. It was a part of who they were. He looked at the pointy pine leaves reflected in the glacial water. It was a permanence that made his daily stresses appear petty and trivial. The moment spent standing and looking was only a few seconds, but it seemed to him that he'd been standing there for a long time. Maybe a part of him had been standing there forever and would continue standing long after his transient body had begun to move again. He smiled slowly, a long, drawn-out smile, and put his arm around Freya. We're here. Let's go inside.
I just love that.
I'll stop there.
you craft scenes so perfectly. I mean, there's, like, really no dialogue or anything, but you, with the internal thought and just the description of what's going on, I mean, it just draws you in. That's just perfect. Now, I have a question for you, just because you read that. I know a lot of authors usually start from, like, well, I mean, obviously, we all usually have outlines, or we should, at least if we want to have a story that doesn't run away from us. But when you actually sit down and start, you know, crafting, you know, the core of your book, do you tend to work from the beginning to the end, or do you start with your scenes, like what you just read, or do you start with your characters and really sketch them out and interview them? Where do you start in your process of writing?
I almost always start with character. And I almost start with a character. I must always start in my head at the very early stages. I will usually start with characters that are sticking with me somehow, that have kind of invented themselves in my own head, and I can't let them go. And then I'll begin working around that character's conflict or issue. And once I've got that clear in my head, and I will do character sketches as well, with a novel, you know, I can't really write off the fly. I really need to know where I'm going with it. So I will then do quite extensive outlining, so that I have, mainly because, I mean, a scene like that is, is not hard for me to write. I do tend to, I guess being a poet first, I tend to, you know, think in terms of internal thought processes and perspectives and perceptions quite naturally. I don't think in terms of plot naturally, though. And I don't naturally think in terms of action. And those are really critical to making good novels. You really need plot. You need strong, you know, strong things have to happen. You need that conflict and you need the action to take place. So I have to have that written out very clearly for me. Otherwise, I'll never get out of the inside of my characters into what's actually happening. So it's important for me to have that. So I will do I spend quite a long time, many months usually, working through exactly what each scene is going to encompass. I won't write them. Sometimes I will write them. I mean, sometimes I'll just, you know, I'll need a break from the plotting, which is, you know, it's really quite hard work. It's quite structural. It's like building a building. You know, it's not fun and creative and intuitive and passionate. It's much more craft than art. So I will spend a lot of time on it. But sometimes if I need a break, I'll just, you know, I'll write a scene. I'll just get into it. And I'm always surprised at how natural and easy that flows compared to the blotting process. Once I can get into my character, I can start, you know, really start playing around with the things that they're seeing and what they're feeling, which again comes quite naturally. But I can't really do that well in the context of a full-length novel, which is, you know, quite a task. There's quite a lot of pieces to it until I've got all those key elements in place. I'm clear about the conflict. I'm clear about the plot. I'm clear about the progression and the scenes. And I've virtually done, you know, beat sheet, really, a kind of a scene-by-scene list, so I know exactly where it's going to go. Well, once I'm writing, that may change a lot, and it often does. You know, I'll get to a situation where I'll think, you know what, I think I'd much rather have this happen than that. Or, you know, I feel quite intuitively that in the context of the character, my characters will tell me, you know, they'll want to do something, and it'll come out of left field. And I'll think, yes, that works better than what I had originally imagined. You know, instead of a brain tumor, it'll be something else. It'll be, you know, this. And that may come quite instinctively as I'm writing, but I still need to have the outline quite clear.
Yeah, it's interesting how that happens. My husband teases me sometimes, so I'll wake up in the middle of the night and kind of, like, talk to myself a little bit, but I'm not really talking to myself. I mean, in my brain, I'm talking to my character, but, of course, I'll kind of be muttering under my breath as I'm trying to remember what, you know, had just popped in my head or something, and he just kind of looks at me like, do we need to take you to the crazy house yet? But it's true, sometimes your characters get in your head, and, I mean, they're literally, like, talking to you as, like, this, you know, out-of-body kind of experience weirdness, and you're just kind of like, whoa. And I used to never understand that, you know, obviously because I was in the world of marketing, and so I never really thought about it until I started writing and taking classes. And I remember when I first started writing, and I'd hear someone, you know, talk about, oh, you know, my cursor will start talking to me and I want them to do this, but they're like insisting to do something totally different that I didn't even think of. And I'm starting thinking, what? But you're the one writing the story. But it's so true how that happens.
Yes.
You know, and it's,
yes,
but, you know,
that's why you have to keep on at it as well, because I think that the brain will start to synthesize the story for you as long as you keep working on it in little bits. And you know, as a writing mama, and I vowed I would use that phrase at least once during this discussion. So, as a writing mama, I don't get big snatches of time to work, really. You know, I can't do a nanny no mo. You know, I can't actually sit down and write a novel in a month. It's just not possible with my life. The children and the world around me is busy and it's noisy, and, you know, there are a lot of distractions, and you have to be able to just kind of get stuck in whenever you can and snatch whatever time you can. But I find as long as I get into it every single day, my brain will do that. The characters will talk and they will synthesize and they will work on their problems in my mind, at the back of my mind, do other things. It might make you a little scatty at times. You're a little scatty at times. That's my excuse.
Oh, I feel like a scatterbrained, which is so weird because in my old life I was never scatterbrained. I was, you know, definitely the suits and, you know, very, very organized. And I am. I'm actually very analytical and very alpha personality. I talk about that a lot too in shows. But for some reason, as I've gotten to my writing life, I've become a little bit more chaotic and scatterbrained than I used to ever be, which I think makes my family very happy because I was definitely a stress case. Major stress case before. But speaking of writing mamas and trying to snatch time and stuff, because I know you have kids and you know, you write as full time as you can, what you know, what's kind of like your writing day like? I mean, I've talked to so many people, and you know, obviously I know it depends on how old your kids are as well, but you know, what is it kind of like for you? Do you break your day up into multiple segments? Do you have like your morning and evening time? What is it kind of like when you get as close to your perfect planned out writing day as you can?
I don't really get the perfect planned out writing day ever. So for me, if I've managed to do, you know, at least a half hour, ideally about an hour a day, that would be, you know, a lot on the long-term creative project. So that would be on a novel or something. Other types of writing I do all the time, almost, you know, almost nonstop, because I have a day job as well, you know, kind of a 9-to-5 myself. And there's a lot of writing involved in that, you know, usually corporate type writing. But nevertheless, it's writing, and it's using language in various types of ways, you know, from working through a library to helping write up a concept paper for something. So there's a whole range of types of writing that I will do for that. I will write poetry at times, which is, you know, something I just purely enjoy. I love writing poetry. It's very relaxing for me. Or I might write a book review, for example, or, you know, might write a blog. And at the moment I'm doing, as you know, my blog tours, which this is a part of it for Black Cow. So I've been doing a lot of blog posts and, you know, answering interview questions and stuff like that, again, which is all types of writing. But it's easy for all of that stuff to distract you from the long-term project, which, you know, which nobody's really clamoring for, and everything else they are. So I usually try and do the serious, significant, creative type work when the kids are in bed, which at the moment they're, my eldest is 14 and my youngest is 9. And I've got a 12-year-old in between as well. So I've got 3 children. And they're usually all pretty much in bed completely. I'm going to sleep by about 10-ish. By the time all 3 of them are in bed. And I will almost always read the first 2 of them bedtime story. My 14-year-old no longer wants one. But that happens. He reads his own bedtime stories now. But even my 12-year-old I'm reading to still, which he still likes, which is fantastic because I love reading bedtime stories. They get more and more challenging. I'm reading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm on the last book now for my 12-year-old.
Oh, my son just finished that. My son loves that book.
One, it's fantastic, and I wish I could write, you know, hysterically funny, profound, alien type farce like Douglas Adams.
That is definitely an art.
You know, even my daughter, she gets quite tricky books too, so that's quite challenging for me from an acting point of view to be able to read those things. So that usually that's about 10 when everybody's completely in bed and my husband will usually be watching television and I can actually really focus in on the longer term creative work. And that's when I'll do, you know, half hour if I'm exhausted and falling asleep over my computer, which sometimes I am, or an hour. And sometimes I just, you know, I just want to read at that point. So, you know, it might only be a half hour and then I'll spend another hour reading before I finally go to sleep. But that's usually where my writing time will occur. If I'm getting close to finishing a novel, like at that point where it's really got a very strong imperative and I feel like I'm you know, getting at that point, I will do a lot more. So I'll often sneak time out of everything else, including things like, you know, keeping the house clean and making dinner and not have a lot of takeaways.
Yes,
so
That really only occurs
in the latter stages of a novel where I'm you know, absolutely desperate to get it done and it's really got a very strong drive going on.
Or you know, especially, you know, once it's with the publisher too and they have, you know, a few revisions or whatever they want too, then you're in deadlines and so that always takes over. Yes, my family loves when I'm in those because that's when I'm like you. It's like takeout and I could care less about cleaning the house. And they're like, yay. Mom's like, you're screaming at us about our messy bedrooms for the next week. It's great. Pushing that week up and then they dread it, of course, because then you're like, oh my gosh, my house is a mess.
But you know, being a writing mama, I think, and the one thing that children teach you, the very first thing I think that children teach you, right from the first pregnancy, I think, is, you know, you have to allow yourself that flexibility, and you have to steal whatever moments you can, and you have to kind of let go of total control.
And I
just,
totally,
you know,
agree.
Say, you know, I've got a half an hour now. You know, maybe my husband's taking the kids out to the shops or something to go and get something, and I'm home alone and I've got time. You just have to go, okay, that's it. This is great. This is quality time. I'm just going to take it now, right now. You know, I'm not going to set up. I'm not going to first clean the area around me. I'm just going to get stuck in, and all of that stuff can happen later. I'm just going to, you know, take this moment now. And that seems to work for me. But, you know, no, I'm not super fast. Definitely, not by any means. But, you know, I feel personally satisfied if I can continue to work on something creative. And that's enough for me at this stage in my kid's life, you know, which is pretty busy and full.
No, that's great. And, I mean, obviously it's hard to balance, you know, being a mom and doing what we love to do. I mean, I don't want to say, and I've had a few writing dads go, well, I want to spend time with my kids too. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, for some reason, for moms, we always tend to have, I think, more, I mean, yeah, they have to balance, you know, writing, and if they have a full-time job, and of course, spending time with their family, because I know quite a few male authors who were working full-time jobs before they could actually quit those jobs and be a full-time, you know, writer, and still, you know, wanted to write and had young kids at home. But I think with moms, I mean, we have the house chores, and we're thinking about, you know, or if the kids get sick, I mean, I think we have a little bit more pressure on us at times. So it sounds like, you know, the balance
morning,
you have,
yeah,
is working at least, because I know it can be hard trying,
yeah,
to balance all of that.
I think we're, as a, I don't know if I should generalize, because I'm sure there are exceptions, but I think women tend to be a little bit more naturally disposed to guilt.
Yes, we do. I have to say this too, because my husband will say, that's not true. I feel more guilty than you do. And he does. He wears his heart, I think, more out on his shoulder than I do. I can turn off, I guess, the switch if I need to, because if I'm really in deadlines, I'm like, go deal with your, have dad deal with it. I'm busy, but that's because I know he's here. If he's not here, then, of course, I'm like, oh, sympathetic and guilty, and like, oh, let me help you. This can just wait. But, yeah, I do understand what you're saying. That I think women in general tend to be a little bit more sympathetic and a little bit more guilt-prone in many ways. Is there anything you would love to leave with our listeners as our time's running down? I mean, obviously, I'd love for you to share your websites with them as well, because you always have great tips for those who want to learn to write. I always love reading your blog. Of course, you know, where they can find out more about you and your writing as well, and anything you have going on. And yeah, I know you do book reviews and stuff, so there might even be some authors who maybe want you to do some book reviews for them.
Yes, I do a lot of different things. yes, sure. Well, let me first say that the best way to find all of my books, including Black Cow, is to just drop my website, which is simply www.magdalenaball.com. So that's everything is there, links to my blog and links to that wonderful little mini book that my publisher put together that you mentioned, and you've got a direct link to that too. It's a cute little thing. It's really lovely. It actually, you can flip the pages, and if you've got your sound on, you can even hear the pages turning. So they've done a lovely job with that, and that's got an excerpt. So people are welcome to go get a copy of that. You can actually download it and have it on your computer and check it out. And, of course, the book is available on Kindle as well as in paperback form. And with Kindle, as Kindle lovers know, you can always download a sample as well and just, again, just check it out and see if you like it and, you know, enjoy the sample. If you want a Kindle Graph, I've got it up on Kindle Graph, so I'd be happy to Kindle Graph it, which is like a kind of autograph on the Kindle. And if you do buy a hard copy and you'd like me to send you a very nice little book plate, I'd be more than happy to send out a quick book plate with a customized autograph on it. Well, all right.
That was my dog barking because someone knocked on our front door, so I'm leaving that room. About that, everybody.
That's right. I thought I'd let my animals, my roosters, out after we finished. Crow it back.
I know they always go off at the wrong time. The animals. I'm like, oh, and I have a little miniature schnauzer, so of course he has that really high pitched bark. So, but. Yeah, and we do have the link to your, so for our listeners, so they know, we do have a link to your website and, of course, to the mini book in the description page of today's show, so definitely click on that. Gosh, it's been great having you on. I mean, you're so full of information, and your writing is beautiful. I'm so glad you read, you know, a little snippet of your book, Black Cow, because if I could just write, I'm really good with dialogue, and I'm good with my character development and stuff, but I really wish my descriptions would be just as fluid as yours are. I mean, they're just beautifully crafted, and you're a gifted writer, so I'm happy to have you on our show and to share about your newest book. And of course, anytime you have a new book, let us know, because Marcia and I would always be happy to have you on one of our shows at the World of Ink Network here on Blog Talk, because you're just so fun to have on.
Thanks so much, Virginia. I really appreciate your support and all your kind words, and I will definitely let you know when the next book is out.
All right, and you know, if anybody ever wants to get a hold of Maggie, you're more than welcome to, of course, contact us here at Blog Talk Radio, and we can help get those links for you if you can't find them on our site as well. Marcia and I are always happy to connect readers and authors together, so definitely, you know, email us through our site here at the World of Ink Network. And it's been great having you. I hope, I want to say it's probably really late for you out there in Australia, since you're flipped to us in our time. Of course, you're enjoying warmer weather than we are. Of course, no, you're in fall now, aren't you? Your weather.
We are just in autumn, or fall, as you like to call it, over there in your part of the world.
Yeah.
It's actually 10:01 a.m., so we are a day ahead of you.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful morning here. The sun is shining.
Well, my goal is to eventually get out your way. That is one of my lifetime goals, is to get out to Australia and see it in my lifetime, because I've always been very fascinated with that part of the world, and I've met a lot of people from Australia, and they're always such fun people. You guys are very, very friendly. You don't meet very many friendly people in some places.
I grew up in the U.S., so I'm actually a Yank by birth. But, I do love it out here. I love it out here.
Really?
And my kids are all, they're
how
all Australian.
How long have you lived in Australia? I know we're towards the end of the show, but I'm just curious, because you have such a strong accent. So how long have you been living there then?
About 24 years or so.
Okay, that's why you picked up some of it. Because I'm like, you can hear some of the accent in your voice. So I'm like, I would never have realized that you actually are, you know, U.S. born.
Yeah. I am. I grew up in the U.S., and my family's still over there as well, so I'm definitely I'm a dual citizen.
Well, it's been great having you on, and definitely we'll have to have you back on our show again.
Thank you so much, Virginia. I really appreciate you having me on the show. It's been great talking to you.
Okay. You take care. And for all our listeners, just so you know, we do have the What is Success show coming up this Friday. Marcia and I are getting the show scheduled tonight, so it will be on our World of Ink Network page soon. So you guys can tune into that. That's always a great show that we have about every other Friday, where we share different tips from marketing to book publishing to writing. So definitely tune in, and you can always post questions or call in with your questions. And we wish you all a good evening or morning, depending on where you're at in this part of the world. And take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Follow me to the World of Ink.